Hello, and welcome to Making Creativity Pay, the podcast where we talk to people in creative industries about how they promote and market their work. I'm Dan Barnett, and on this episode, ahead of the Glasgow Comedy Festival, which runs from the 13th to the 31st of March, I spoke to comedians Jay Lafferty and Kathleen Hughes, two Scottish comedians who are performing at the festival, talk about their work, the realities of being a comedian from the perspective of it being a full-time job, or as a relative newcomer developing their experience. We discuss the Fringe, touring and gigging across the country, and the support network that exists within Scottish comedy. I started the interview by asking Kathleen and Jay to give a bit more info about themselves and their experiences in comedy.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Hughes. I'm a Glaswegian stand-up, and I started stand-up in January 2020, which is not a good time to start doing anything. So I mean, very quickly kind of went into lockdown and things like that, but I'd already got the bug by March, and so that was kind of a couple of Zoom gigs. And then come kind of the end of summer 2021, when we got to actually perform live again, I was just like so convinced that I wanted to grab it that I think I went a bit mad with it. It was, you know, so exciting. So I'm really glad that I stuck to it. I can see another reality where lockdown happened and I thought that's a sign, but still doing it, still good.
When you say got the bug, I thought you meant COVID for a second. You mean the comedy bug?
Oh, no. I mean, I did get that as well, but yeah, I meant, comedy bug.
And you, Jay?
Hi, I'm Jay Lafferty. I am a stand-up comedian, producer, and community artist. I have been doing stand-up comedy for 20 years. Just disgusting. I started when I was 21, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I'm still here. Yeah. I've been doing it for all this time, and I've had periods where I've had full-time employment alongside doing stand-ups. For the last 10 years, I've pretty much been fully employed, self-employed, with a little pie chart of existence, for which stand-up probably makes up about 85% of that pie chart.
Cool. So Kathy, you're saying, you know, it's been about 4 years now, but a couple of months ago you were the final of the New Comedian of the Year. That's the thing, you know, new doesn't mean, you know, you've just had an idea 10 minutes ago. It's, you know, new within comedy is still, you know, it can take quite a time to kind of build. I mean, how was the experience at the final?
Oh, it was great. I've done a few of these kind of new act competitions, and I think they're kind of increasingly tempting to people who are starting out as comedians. I did Guildable and So You Think You're Funny in 2021. That went quite well. I got to the final of that, and it was like a real, not just that I got to meet a lot of people who I think it would have taken a lot longer for me to meet. But I got to learn a lot kind of very quickly. So I think they do become a little bit kind of addictive. I've had some where I went and I just felt like the biggest idiot. I could not believe that I'd spent the money getting there to do 5 minutes to idiot myself and then go. Because a lot of them are in London, you feel like you're a new kid at school and everyone else knows each other. And sometimes that can be a wee bit difficult. And as well, because they do have like a real variance. So they go from you have to be doing this for less than 6 months up to like 5 years. There can be a real kind of variance in the experience of the people that you're, I don't want to say competing against, but essentially that you're performing with. And it's a very quick way to learn. But I think sometimes there's a lot of kind of value put on competitions that in terms of like your worth as a comedian or a performer, as opposed to quite a nice thing to put on a poster. You know, it was a great experience. I really enjoyed Leicester Square. Everyone was so friendly. You know, the David from Museum of Comedy, David Hardcastle, who runs the competition, was so great. I had a great experience with that one. I think that's maybe for London, for sure, my favourite kind of competition I've taken part in.
Yeah. And so it was on Next Up as well, because I think I saw some of the acts on. I mean, did you get much feedback from that as well?
I got a couple, which is always nice. Like, I think you kind of forget. I think this is part of what's kind of interesting as a new comedian. When you start, it's because you liked writing or you liked stand-up or you wrote something funny and you thought, well, let me try it. And then the longer you kind of stay in and you realise how important, like, people will see you, which is not a thing that you think of kind of when you start. People will form an opinion of you. People will see you before. And you need to think about, you know, marketing yourself or what kind of work you want to be doing, all that sort of thing. So when someone messages and says, hey, I saw you on Next Up, I really enjoyed it, and who wasn't in the room with you, it's this kind of reminder that people are watching, and that's very nice, and it's also quite scary.
Yeah, so obviously that was done in London, and Jay, you're today in Birmingham. So, I mean, Jay, obviously you're both based in Scotland. I mean, how do you find that kind of balance? I'll start with Jay. So, you know, gigging in Birmingham tonight, is that like a whole weekend? Do you try and cram in a few different gigs to make the most of it?
Well, for the Glee comedy clubs, when you're coming down, they pay for your accommodation and your food and different bits and bobs like that. So it's pretty much exclusive. I'm down here gigging for them. Quite often when comedy clubs pay for you to come down to do something, there's a kind of exclusivity deal to say that you won't gig, you know, kind of within a certain radius. So generally when I come and gig for the Glees, I just come down and I do their gigs. They're always really lovely gigs. They're very well paid. Quite often you get kind of extra gigs on top. So they've got two rooms. So if it's very busy, which isn't the case because obviously it's January, but generally if you're down in the kind of busier months, there's two shows a night. So, you know, you kind of, you're getting paid very well for being there, and also they look after you really well too. So yeah, I don't tend to try and cram in lots of other gigs. When I'm away, if I'm in London, that's a kind of different situation. But generally, if I'm out and about, I'll go and do the gigs that I have been, you know, kind of booked for. And then generally, I will try and use the time constructively because I'm a mum. So having a weekend away is... It's very hard to be away from your family, but what I try and do is, you know, if I've got writing deadlines or like at the moment I'm sitting doing some tax stuff, so I just try and, or I'm doing this pod with you guys. So yeah, I just try and fit in as many other bits and bobs around being away as I can. So I suppose it's that sort of maximising your time.
And Kathleen, I mean, how do you find it? Because obviously that new comedian, for example, that was down in London on a Sunday night. So is that like, that's a kind of a weekend of your time, and it's obviously not cheap to travel anywhere these days.
Yeah. I think that's one thing that I would really recommend for new comedians. Like, there is a work-life balance element that I'm still trying to kind of get a hold of. So I have a full-time day job, which I love, and which is flexible enough for me to be able to say, I need to take that Monday off. Is that all right? Which is fantastic. But there is only there's only so many hours in the day, and there's only so much energy and effort you can put into stuff before you're going to hit a wall. And that's not fun for anyone. So what I tend to do is, if I've decided that I want to go somewhere for a gig that's I'm not being paid to go there, I've just decided I would like to do it, then I try to make sure that, like, I have friends in London, so I'll make sure that I'm going to see them as well, or I'm going to go to a museum that I've always wanted to go to or something like that. Turn it into kind of a weekend, or do more gigs. You know, if you're able to get more open spots, or like gong shows are very kind of, a lot of people like to go and try out different gigs in different cities as well, trying your material, seeing if it works and when you're not at home, that sort of thing. If you're going to spend the money to do it, it's pretty devastating. I've been there where you spend the money to do 5 minutes at competition and you feel like you don't deliver your best self. So it's good to have, like, I'm seeing my friends for lunch tomorrow, I'm going to do this other gig tomorrow night, I'm going to this museum. Turn it into something, you know, like Jay says, use the time to not make it entirely about like being on stage, because otherwise you're spending a lot of money for something that's supposed to be fun and becomes very high pressured.
It feels like a hard way to make an easy living. If you do it and you enjoy it, but is it still a job, or does it feel different to you, Jay?
I think it's one of those things that it definitely is a job, and it's one of those jobs that takes over your whole life. So if you didn't enjoy it, then you shouldn't do it, because it's a very quick way to become bitter very quickly. So I think it's one of those things that you have to enjoy it to do this job, because it is a lot of work. It is, you know, it is kind of all consuming, and there's that total comedian thing that when anything happens in your life, you instantly think, how can I mine this for content? Which is a weird world to live in. And you also give up a lot as a comedian, you know, so you don't see your friends at the weekend because that is when you gig. You know, you have to forgo, like, I've had to forgo big life events like people's birthdays and weddings and christenings because, you know, I've been away working. And sometimes people find that quite difficult, you know, the people that you love in your life. And I think now, because I've been doing it for such a long time, they've kind of understood it. But I have had to have difficult conversations with people to say, well, I wouldn't expect you to, you know, meet me for coffee at 11 a.m. on a Wednesday. So, you can't expect me to meet you for coffee at 11 a.m. on a Saturday because I'm actually in, you know, Cardiff. It definitely is a job, but it's a job that you have to love, and I don't regret it. I sometimes feel incredibly privileged that I get paid, you know, what I get paid for essentially, if you wanted to look at it bare bones, 20 minutes work. You know, when there's people who get paid less than me for working 16-hour shifts. So, you know, it's a big privilege to be able to do it. But it is hard. Being a creative is hard. And being a stand-up, I think, is one of the tougher ones because it's very singular. You know, if you're in a band or an actor or whatever, you've got a cast and or you've got musicians and everything around you. And the stand-up, you know, a lot of the time you're on the road yourself. Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel about it? Because you're kind of in that stage now where if you wanted to push, it could become your job, you know, your main source of income. Do you have kind of sleepless nights about that, thinking, oh my God, is that what I want to do? Or is, you know, have you got the balance right already?
No. I think when I started, you're going to start spending money. And at first I was like, well, I would spend this on, if I had like a sport that I really enjoyed doing, I would spend this on all this stuff for the sport. I would buy, if I was Monroe bagging every weekend, I'd buy nice hiking boots, you know, and that starts with that. That's like a train to Dundee in my head. That would be like a sensible jacket, you know. You start to kind of justify little expenses to yourself because you're doing something fun and something you love and enjoy. And why would you not, you know, spend money that you have on that? And then you kind of go, well, if I really like skiing, I might go on a ski holiday because the expenses get a little bit more intense as you get up. But you know, there is an extent to, there's a really difficult balance between looking at your life and your budget and saying, right, okay, I'm starting to get paid gigs. Those at the start will not be like with a reliable frequency. Some places pay more than others, some places are further away, you need to spend that on getting there, all that sort of thing. It is like a real balancing act between your day-to-day life. And I think there is a real idea around new, like early career comics. I don't know what you think, Jay. I think it's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that we've given ourselves where you can't say no to a gig because then you're unreliable or they won't book you again. They won't ask you again. And I know a lot of people who will push themselves to do gigs that, you know, they've been working like a 40-hour work week and they have care responsibilities. But, you know, someone's offered them a gig, so they are going to take it. And it's, even if it's financially not really viable for them that week or whatever. I wish it was a bit more normalized, just amongst us even, not even, you know, people who are offering new work to say, thank you very much for the offer. I can't do this one. Please let me know when there's another one. Because that's, you know, that's not you refusing work. It's just you saying, I can't make it this week. I think that's really important. Again, Jay has been doing this for years and years. I've very recently kind of tried to redirect myself into like a creative industry. But I think that's something that I've learned very quickly is that you have to listen to yourself and your situation and say, right, this is the work I can actually take on and still do it well. Otherwise, I'm going to be, you know, turning up to stuff underprepared. I won't care about it, that sort of thing. And that just becomes completely untenable and not fun.
I mean, have you been in those situations? You see that in other acts as well, Jay, that, you know, maybe they're pushing too hard and can't say no and, you know, find it difficult to have that balance?
I think, you know, like any self-employed job, it is really difficult to say no because you have no idea what's coming around the bend, you know. And I think probably my most, on reflection, my most kind of obvious story around that was when I had my son. Obviously, when you're self-employed, you've got no, you don't have maternity leave, right? So you don't, nobody's paying for you to go off and have a baby. And I was very aware of that. And I'd done all sorts of things. Like I'd saved up a little pot of money in case I wasn't able to work because I was like an older mum or a geriatric mum, as they adore calling us. She's very depressing. So I was an older mum. So I had all these like complications that could have happened. And so I had thought, right, okay, I'm gonna make sure that I've got a little cushion should I, you know, not be able to work. So I had that, but I worked the whole way through my pregnancy. I worked up until the night before I gave birth. I did the fringe 7.5 months pregnant. And I did 102 shows in a month. Because in the back of my head, I was like, right, well, you might have a really difficult birth. So you might want to have to take 4 or 5 months off after you have the wee one. So you need to make sure you've got enough money for that as well. So, you know, constantly I was working. I went back to work. I had a very, I don't say very traumatic birth. I think all births are fairly traumatic. I had quite a difficult birth. I was in labour for 72 hours. And went into septic shock and a whole load of, you know, just different things went on. And I was back at work within 3 weeks. Yeah, so I went back to work 3 weeks after I'd given birth. And the whole time I was like, yeah, I'm fine. It's absolutely fine. And then I did the whole of, so I went back to work on the 7th of December. And the start of December, it doesn't really matter. Anyway, I went back to work because I knew it was Christmas and because I knew that those gigs were, you know, worth a lot of money. And also if I, and in the head, I was like, if I don't do these Christmas gigs this year, I'm not going to get offered them next year. And I really need to do all this. So I did all of this, went back to work, had a baby on my chest while I'm doing stand-up, comparing with my son attached to me. And, I did all of this, which was fine. And then the pandemic hit 3 months later. And when I reflected back on it, I just thought, when I had that opportunity to stop for probably the first time properly in about 15, 16 years and reflect back, I just realised how absolutely mad that was. How insane it was to, you know, have, in particular, because I went through 10 years of IVF. To have my son. So I didn't take any time off during that. I did all of that and I had, you know, miscarriages, all sorts of things. I never took any time off. Then got pregnant, didn't take any time off, then had a baby and took 3 weeks off and then came straight back in. And it was really the pandemic that made me stop and reflect back on that and see what everybody else saw, which was that that was an insane choice. I'm quite grateful for the pandemic in some ways, in terms of my own mental health, because it actually made me stop and reflect. You can't do everything all the time, and saying no to something doesn't mean that you'll never get asked to do it again. And actually, you're far better taking a step back and a breath and making sure that you're well. So it was a big lesson.
So obviously, you're both based in Scotland, and so obviously 11 months of the year comedy is quite a London centric thing, but 1 month, you know, absolutely everything is up there. But I mean Cathy, how have you found the Scottish comedy circuit?
Great, you know, there's lots of, I was kind of mentioned this earlier when we were speaking, I don't see myself as someone who's a very natural comic. Maybe I shouldn't say that, it's something that's going to be published online, but you know, I'm quite a nervous person, quite self-conscious, and I was ready for trying to, you know, do more comedy to be like the same things you hear about any creative pursuit, that it's super competitive, you're going to have thick skin, that you're going to get a lot of feedback that you're not going to enjoy hearing, but you have to hear it to make you better. And to the extent that's true, but I went in and I was like, I don't care if anyone thinks I'm not supposed to be here, I'm supposed to be here. And then everyone went, yeah, you are. Like, it was completely fine. And of course, like with any kind of community or your workplace, you'll have people you get along with really well and people who you don't have as much in common with. And, you know, sometimes there's, you know, drama, or right, it's actually not a lot of drama. I don't know why I said that, but you'll have people who disagree occasionally. But yeah, it's been really welcoming. And like Leah Watanella, who you had on recently, I was speaking to him a couple of weeks ago about, you know, trying to put together my first solo show and things like that. He was just giving me loads of advice. He couldn't have been more helpful. When I first started comedy after the pandemic, I messaged Christopher MacArthur Boyd and asked if I could buy him a coffee and just ask him all the stupid questions that I was really nervous about. And he said, yeah, absolutely. And it just seems like it's that kind of community. You know, there are a lot of nice people. Everyone wants to see the comedy as a general amorphous thing improve and be good. I think we have like a real pride for Scottish comedy and all the things that is and all the people that are in it. So anything that supports each other is like great. It's not a competitive kind of toxic environment. And I think a lot of that has to do with like people who, before I started in comedy, put a shift in to make sure that was the case. But I'm very grateful for that, because since I've started, obviously, occasionally you'll get, you know, disagreements between people, but it's, on the whole, it's a really nice scene.
Jay, I mean, how have you found it? And has it always been like that? Or do you think things have changed in more recent times?
Oh, no, it's definitely not always been like that. It's definitely a very forward-thinking community, the Scottish comedy community, and it's very open and welcoming. And, you know, as I totally would agree with Kathleen, that there has been people who have put a shift in to make it so because of negative experiences in the past. And particularly the women within Scottish comedy have, you know, they've really worked hard to make sure that we are getting rid of a lot of the stereotypes that went on before, and a lot of the challenges that female comedians would come up against. You know, like there only been one female on a bill, or, you know, this whole kind of, and this is not just a comedy thing, but that whole patriarchal, you know, another woman's success is, you know, your downfall. So we've worked really hard, and there's been people like Jojo Sutherland, Susan Morrison, Janie Godley, Susie McCabe, Joe Caulfield. And we've worked really hard to make sure that that sort of, that female comedians are supporting other female comedians, and that we've got a united front against, you know, some of the sexism that can prevail in the industry, and that we are, you know, mentioning. I think it's such an important thing that, particularly like with what Kathleen's saying of going, you know, you're terrified of turning stuff down. Now, if I'm unable to do something, the first thing that I will do is try and raise up another comedian, and if at all possible, another female comedian. So, you know, I think mentioning other women's names in a room full of opportunities is how we challenge and change the industry from the inside. And I think it's so important, you know, to do that. And it's great. There's lots of fantastic male comics who are doing the same work, who are also, you know, kind of supporting female and female identifying people, and people from, you know, just a variety of different backgrounds that were not as seen within comedy. You know, I mean, it's not that they weren't there, but they weren't seen, because there's always been people of colour. There's always been people from the LGBTQ plus background. There's always been comics, you know, who've got different lived experiences, but for a very long time, your straight white men were the ones that were seen. And so I think that we've all now got a collective responsibility to make sure that our community is reflective of the people who are in it. And that's, you know, everybody. And these are all people who have always been there, but who have just not had the opportunity to shine.
Yeah, I would really like to. Yeah, I think it's easy to take for granted sometimes the fact that, like, being a new comedian, to see the standard of women comedians in Scotland, like Jay and Susie and Jojo and like everyone that Jay just mentioned and didn't mention herself, but including Jay, there's like no question. I was ready to have to defend the fact that women are funny and that I am funny and I am good at this. There was no question about whether or not that was the case, because there are all these women who are like incredibly funny, but also like incredibly hardworking, incredibly like good at what they do, and thoughtful and skillful. So yeah, it's just been like a very empowering experience in general. And I think it's something that, like, to remind yourselves of now and then, because you risk, when you don't appreciate the work that's gone into making something nice, you risk fumbling the ball a bit. So, you know, you need to keep that in mind and be nice to people who are coming in. And I like that feeling of the more you know, the more you don't know. You know, the more I learn, the more I realise that, you know, there's still a lot to learn.
So, I mean, a lot of people I've had on, a lot of London-based, but an awful lot of time we talk about the Fringe and, you know, how that's the kind of pinnacle or the focus of the year for an awful lot of people. For you guys up there most of the time already, I mean, how different does that month feel to everything else? And is it a big focal point for you both as well?
Yeah, I think that the fringe has seasons and it goes through changes. And I think at the moment, and certainly over the last few years since the pandemic, there's been a big change for the benefit of the Scottish-based community, comedy community at the fringe. Well, certainly within comedy, I have no idea outside of, you know, in the kind of theatre and music and all that sort of thing. But I think for a long time, London used to just come up and squat in our attic, do you know what I mean? They would just come up and just, you know, barge in and push everybody who had been there for the whole of the year previous to the side and sweep in with all of their things that they wanted to showcase. And I think that that's definitely changed now. Certainly the tide turned massively last year with all of the Scottish comics having really stellar years, like everybody having, you know, sold out shows, extra shows getting put on, fantastic reviews, all supporting. And again, that's part of all supporting each other. You know, every comedian that I went to see, every Scottish based comedian had some sort of either shout out or list of other Scottish based comedians that people could go and see, which was amazing to see. And I went to a lot of other people's shows. None of the rest of them had that. But all of the Scottish acts had this sort of support within the community, which was great. And yeah, so I think that it's really nice to see the Scottish acts getting a little bit of recognition, because previously that didn't happen. And I think it's happening at all levels as well, from the very kind of people starting out and maybe doing their first foray into doing a show. So they're maybe doing a split bill or they're doing 40 minutes. They had good success right up to, you know, your people like Frankie and Susie and all these people who are in big rooms with everything that's associated with that. So it was nice. It's nice to see, and I'm hoping that it continues, a little bit more of a shared focus and it not just being like London's garden party.
Kathleen, so the Fringe last year you did, was it a week, 10 days?
It was 2 weeks.
Was that as much kind of fitting in with the day job, or you just wanted to kind of build up and you didn't have the confidence, or, you know, kind of think, well, maybe it's not quite there yet? Or where were you? And is the plan that this year, yes, it's going to be a full month?
Yeah. So the plan this year is to go for the full month, which is very exciting and nerve-wracking. You know, I think it was mostly this idea of, yeah, fitting it in with my day job and still having like annual leave for other stuff that like socializing and seeing friends. There is a kind of, like Jay says, there is a sense I have this year of I will have to compromise things. If I'm taking this step, if I'm kind of changing gear, then there are going to have to be things. I will have to use up all of my leave on this month, which is fine. And I'm very grateful to have like a job where I get annual leave. I've had plenty of jobs where there were 0 hour contracts that I would simply have to quit. And that would be like a huge kind of, and then even if financially I managed it, it would be like a huge mental load to take on. It'd be a lot of anxiety and stress around that. So when I started last year, I had a work in progress show. It was really nice. I really enjoyed it. I got into that rhythm of like working on the show every day, but I still had the kind of security of, you're going back to your day job after this. This isn't, you know, you're not pushing quite over the edge yet. I didn't feel, it wasn't a lack of confidence, but I think maybe a bit of self-awareness just to say you're not quite ready for the next step. That's okay. We're going to do this now. And then you'll be ready by next year, which we'll see. But I think it was mostly that. It was just like, I've never really been one to run before I can walk. So I just like to kind of make sure if I'm going to do something that is a bit of a risk or a bit of a gamble, I want to give myself like a really good, stable platform to work on. And the difficult part of that is not getting caught up in, kind of as you were saying there, this idea that, you know, you're watching everyone else who's also a comedian, kind of the same experience level as you, and we're all going to post that we did great at this thing and we got this gig and we got this review and it was amazing. So you feel like you have a kind of constant juggling of, oh, I need to also do that, or think I'm worse than them, or they're going to think I'm, as much as like it's great to see other people doing well, I don't think it's a competitive thing and that you want to outshine them, but it is that you need to keep up. And the real struggle for me has just been like listening to myself, looking at my work, trying to be objective about it and see, do you feel ready for this step or not? You know, because when we're at this point where, you know, you might have a day job, you might have other like income streams, this is when you do have a bit of flexibility Before I get into that point where I'm completely self-employed, I want to make sure that I've thought things through carefully. Do you know what I mean? I feel like quite a kind of long answer to that.
We're at the stage now, so it's mid-January. I mean, do you already have a room and a time in place, or are you in discussions?
Yeah. So it's not quite confirmed yet. I don't know how much I can, as if I'm under some sort of clause.
Within that, obviously, if you were, say, doing 9 o'clock, that's probably a harder spot to get because that's probably quite a nice spot. But it would then mean you could possibly, to some extent, still work as well, at least some of the days. Whereas if you were doing a 3 p.m. gig, then that would kind of take up your whole day.
I think I would try kind of everything reasonably within my power to not do my day job during the Fringe. Being able to do the Fringe already hinges a lot on me living in Glasgow, living really near Edinburgh. If I didn't have the option to, you know, stay with friends or family or come home certain nights, if I had to pay for accommodation for the full month, I would not be able to afford to do it. So I think with that kind of in mind, that I want to be able to actually fully commit my brain power to it. It's I've only done 2 weeks before and they were work in progress, and I didn't give myself a big financial risk with it. It's very tiring. And some of the worst I've felt, I was like, maybe I shouldn't say that, but yeah, some of the worst I've felt in quite a wee while has been at the Fringe, just because it's so intense and it's everywhere and you are comparing yourself to all of your friends and peers constantly. And saying to yourself, you know, you're doing fine, it doesn't matter, you just focus on yourself. It's very intense. So I would, if possible, try to not do any other particular work during the Fringe. I know that's not possible for everyone, and think I'll be able to manage it. But it's just one of those things where you have to, you know, look at a workload and say, right, okay, if I speak to my colleagues at my day job and they say, we really need you to do this, I'm going to have to move stuff around, you know, but you can only do what you can do.
No, I think it makes a lot of sense, folks. I mean, one guest we had previously, I mean, they were doing a month of the theatre show, and I think they ended up having to miss a week of the Fringe, you know, because they got ill during it. And obviously, A, being in crowded rooms probably doesn't help, the stress of it and everything else. And yes, if you have to do a day job as well, you'll probably do badly at the day job and badly at the Fringe as well. And it'll be for nothing, which, yeah. But it is, like you said, a difficult balance. I mean, Jay, are you performing? Do you have a show for this year? Or obviously you did Bahookie last year. So it's...
Yeah, so no, I'm not taking a new show to the Fringe this year. I am taking Bahookie on tour throughout the whole of this year. And so Bahookie will be returning to the Fringe for 5 days, I think I'm coming for 5 days in a bigger room. I will be at the Fringe. I will be hosting Late and Live, and I've got a whole load of other things that I'm doing. But I'm not taking a new hour because Bahookie was such a huge, huge undertaking. And I just don't have another show in me. I think this cycle of having to write something new every year is insane. And you know, I think there's quite a few of my kind of peers who are similarly not going to be taking a new show this year because the shows that they did last year were big shows. You know, I think sometimes at the Fringe, you go through seasons of, you know, you'll do a show for, you know, because you've got some new club set stuff and you just want to work up a new club set, and that's great. And, you know, you've got a whole month there to work up a nice, lovely 25 minutes. Other times you've got what we call like a large scale theatrical production Fringe, where you've got, you know, a show with a beginning, middle and an end and a story to tell. And I think when you do those types of shows, to try and then recreate that in a completely new way within 12 months is insane. And no other, you know, no other industry would kind of expect that. And I actually think we were talking about this last night in the green room at the Glee, that actually outside of the UK, that's not a thing to do. You know, it's because of the Fringe that we have that. American comedians will work up an hour and they'll do that hour for 10 years. They will do that. They will find a place. They will do that hour. They will tour that hour, and they will do it for a long time. And it's similar in Europe. You know, somebody was saying that a French comedian was saying, again, somebody will write a show that's maybe an hour or 90 minutes, and they'll do that for a decade. And that is their show. And people will come and see that show, and they'll come and see it multiple times because they like that comedian. Whereas here, we have this real, oh no, next, 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 which is, I think, quite unhealthy.
Yeah, I find it interesting that it's kind of, you know, we almost kind of think, what's the purpose of the Fringe? You know, if it's to sell out and have audiences, then yes, you know, you can do the same show. If it's specifically for half a dozen comedy execs, then you almost need to do a new show because they've seen it last year. And so I guess it's kind of where you are and what you're looking for. Yes, you know, even if you sold out 30 gigs last August, you know, Edinburgh is a huge place. You could do exactly the same for, yes, you know, the next 5 years for that act. And it would all be, you know, new people, few who've seen it before would enjoy it. But yes, you know, it wouldn't go stale. There'd be no real reason why you couldn't. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I just think that within the industry, it's a bit of a step change maybe happening now that people are taking a bit more of a breath and thinking about working up tour shows. And for me personally, I would like to be looking at every 2 years bringing something new and then touring it for a year and, you know, and kind of working like that. But I also do children's shows and I also produce theatre shows. So also for me to have any sort of work-life balance, I need a kind of fallow year to be doing things and having different experiences, I guess, which is important.
And I mean, yeah, congratulations, because I mean, I think the tour was announced, I think it was yesterday, wasn't it? So I think Liam, we had him recently, he's doing a similar kind of thing. I think he's taking it, not easier, but he's not producing a new show for Edinburgh. He's kind of, I think, doing some, and he's touring as well. And, you know, he kind of said it's kind of different, whereas, you know, in previous years, he was kind of pasting his own reviews onto boards. And now he's got, you know, a tour company kind of helping with the whole kind of thing. And, you know, he can concentrate more on the work rather than, you know, what we kind of talk about, all the crap that goes on around it and all the things you have to do to constantly keep relevant, keep being noticed, try and push tickets. And I mean, are you looking forward to that? The kind of go around, and so it's a kind of different kind of thing, and instead of being in one place for a month, see a bit of the country and yeah, kind of, you know, expand.
Yeah, I am. I'm looking forward to doing the tour. I'm looking forward to, this has been my second tour. So I did a little tiny Scottish tour of one of my shows in 2018, which was really good. But kind of going back to, you know, the purpose of the Fringe and kind of picking up on what Kathleen had said, I was told very early on in my career that when you do the Fringe, to have a personal goal. And I've spoken to other comedians about this because I think it's really important. So each year that I do the Fringe, I go, what do I want to get from this? Like, what's the purpose? And it can be something as small as wanting to get some new quotes, right? So when I very first started doing Fringe, I actually didn't do a full run at the Fringe for a very long time. So I had been doing comedy for nearly 15 years before I did a run. I've been doing them for 7 years now. So whatever it was, I had been doing, it took me a long time to actually take a full run up. And the reason that I decided to do it in the end was that I wanted some new quotes and I just didn't have any new quotes. And then I think it's like, if you have a goal each time, so for another one, I wanted to do a tour. For another one, I wanted it to be turned into a radio show. And I just made little, so instead of trying to focus on that whole big game of the Fringe and trying to, you know, compete with everybody else, I would do things that specifically were about achieving that one goal. So, you know, I would speak to, when I wanted it to be in a radio show, I focused on radio executives coming to see it. I focused on pushing it within that industry. I focused on writing it in a particular way that it translated to radio. I pitched, you know, particular show ideas for shows, and it did. And I managed to get that. Each time I've managed to achieve my goal, but I think it's very important that to have a goal and work towards that, and don't make your goal winning the award, because that is insane.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Kathleen, yeah, so we're about, yeah, 6 months out. So let's say you're doing a 60-seater venue, 25 nights, that's 1,500 tickets. I mean, do you think of it in that sense of, you know, kind of, so you've got 6 months to kind of build up And you, how much do you try and do before August happens? That, you know, you've got 500 sold, you've got bums on seats already, versus kind of trying to push it literally on the day?
I honestly don't know. And I think that's something that I've been a bit embarrassed with admitting. I've just never done this. And I think that's part of it. I am doing a work in progress at the Elsa Comedy Fest. I have some other work in progress previews and planning stages just now. I'm trying to like put as much as I can into it. So I have, you know, these are the magazines I'm going to get in touch with. These are the, but I think what I actually want is to, like Jay was saying, my goal for this is to, I don't know, successfully do the show. I just want to have written a show and for it to be there. I want to not make a huge loss that is absolutely devastating financially. I want to get some nice reviews and some nice quotes. I'm not aiming for a sellout. That seems like very, I would love to do that. And I, you know, I have a lot of plans in mind in terms of marketing and all that sort of thing. I'm really excited about kind of how I've decided to kind of work the marketing of the show. But I think kind of as Jay was saying there, if I say, you know, I'm going to have this many tickets sold by this time for something I've never done before, I could be way out, you know. I am going to do everything I can and I'm going to listen to people who know more than me and we'll see what happens, really. So I think, I don't know, Jay, maybe you've got some good advice with regards to that, but I think if I give myself goals that aren't well informed, then I'm going to be very disappointed by some of them.
I think that when it comes to the fringe, because you know, you've got your kind of costs in mind, you know, you know what you need to break even, and I think that a way of kind of looking at that is breaking it down to know how many tickets do I have to sell every day to break even. So it doesn't cost me anything for being here, but I don't make anything for being here. And for some people, breaking even at the fringe is a goal, is just a pipe dream, you know. And that's, and I'm not just talking about, you know, acts. That's for huge acts. That can just be a pipe dream. Just because the bigger the act they are, the more costs are involved, weirdly. And so I think, like, if you know, okay, so I have to have 30 people every day to break even, and then you have a day when you've only sold 4 tickets. Well, okay, but actually sometimes looking at it is you need one sellout Saturday. Yeah. So everything is, it's always, it's a movable feast. And I think going into the fringe with, I never think about pre-sales going into the fringe, because the world is changing all the time. We're in a cost of living crisis. I thought last year's fringe was going to be quite quiet because of the cost of living crisis, because of gas and electricity being all over the place, all of that. And I was so pleasantly surprised that, okay, what didn't happen is we didn't have a lot of international travellers, but there was a huge amount of Scottish punters that came out that never did before. Hence the reason that maybe some of the Scottish acts did a lot better than usual. But again, there's no point in you worrying and tying yourself up in knots about what the world is going to do around you. So I think, like, just focusing on doing the show, doing the best show that you can possibly do, having fun at it, and, you know, knowing that you might have to go out there and flyer and bust your hump and do as many guest spots as you possibly can in order to punt your tickets. That's what it's about. It's about the graft and about and not worrying about what everybody else has seen. I mean, I've seen so many sold out, sold out, sold out, and I know for a fact that a lot of them weren't sold out, you know. So you've got to ignore the game, you know. You've got to play the game, but you've got to, like, not take the game too seriously. And just worry about yourself, focus on your own goals, and try not to get too caught up. I think, like, there's this horrible, and Liam and I talk about this quite a lot during the fringe, we'll laugh about it, is like, how many times have you checked your ticket sales, you know? And I loved the fallow year, like the 2021 fringe, where it was like a mini fringe and not everybody came up, and that was the best range ever. We weren't allowed to fly her, so you didn't have to worry about that. Every show sold out days and days beforehand because it was restricted, because we were all in the restricted seating. And I was like, this is what it's like to not have to worry about your fringe run. How ideal. But yeah, I think just making sure that you know what you need to do and doing as best as you can, but understanding that actually there's a lot you can't control and being okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, how much do you both feel social media plays a part now? So, you know, whether it's Instagram, Twitter, whatever, in getting people through the door, or is it still very much, you know, meeting people on the street, or like you said, guesting in other shows or doing spots, and much more the word of mouth?
I think having a huge social media following is obviously good. It means that you can sell it in advance, all right? So, you know, people like Paul Black, who has never been on the stand-up circuit, but had, you know, sold out shows at the Fringe. But again, only for limited runs, you know, great, huge social media. And it does play a part, but I actually think that the Fringe is just very much still people turning up and seeing what they fancy on the day. So I think that doing guest spots is a huge way of getting people in through the door. So, you know, doing Leighton Lives and Best of Scottish at the Stand and all these types of things really, really helps. And yeah, social media is great, but it's such, you either crack that egg or you don't, you know, it's very difficult. And also you get people with huge social media followings that don't transpire into tickets. So because, you know, maybe their social media following is not coming to the Edinburgh Fringe.
So we got, I mean, you're saying you've got some ideas for marketing. I mean, how much do you have the kind of in your head, the balance between, yeah, printing 10,000 flyers, posters, all that kind of stuff versus more of the online sort of things?
Yeah, I think there's definitely like a place for flyering. And I think, you know, with different festivals like Glasgow Comedy Fest, which is coming up in March, there's a lot of questions around, like, is it worth flyering for and things like that. I think at the Fringe, it's huge. And it's just one of those things that you have to kind of, I've been to two Fringes now for like limited runs and flyered both every day. And I think especially doing kind of themed shows like Best of Scottish, or if it's like a women's lineup or something, people will say, I quite like to see some, you know, I want to go to Scotland and see an actual Scottish Canadian, or I want to, you know, I don't know very many women Canadians, I want to see them, those sorts of things. I'd like to do more. I think having like a really fun, like clear branding for a show, that always entices me to it. So for example, like Jay had a really good one for Bahookie. Crystal Evans, who is an American comedian who's in the Scottish circuit, and she had a brilliant debut show last year that was just like knocked everyone's socks off, but very like impactful poster. So I think things like that, you know, it's not necessarily like the social media marketing aspect or in-person aspect, is the branding of the show good? So I look at that poster and go, oh, I kind of know the sense of humour of this person, or I know what this show's going to be like, I know what it's about, that person seems interesting. I think that's really exciting. I think sometimes you'll see like really smart, funny posters that are kind of like underappreciated, I don't know, the value of just like a good idea for branding. Ruth Hunter is another person as well who does it very well. She did a show that was like about, it was kind of about lockdown, kind of about that feeling of kind of losing, realizing that something's not quite going right in your mind, starting to doubt yourself. And she had this makeup that looked like her skin was like an orange peel, basically. Like she'd become completely unraveled. And it was a very simple poster, but it was really impactful. So I like ideas like that. I think they're exciting.
And Jay, I mean, one of the other areas you've recently started now is the podcast, The Joy Agenda. Was that just something you thought, well, everyone else has got a podcast, why don't I? Or was it something you'd had wanted to do for a while?
So it was something that I had wanted to do for a while. And I actually started one during the pandemic with Crystal Evans and Jojo Sutherland, which was great, great fun to do. But then just with our busy kind of schedules, it never went any further than the pandemic. And it was about being a mum and stuff and comedy, which was great. called How the Mother Half Lives, which I still absolutely adore that title. But the Joy Agenda was basically born out of Bahookie being a really joyful show. So I had focused on writing a show which was about happiness, about joy, about finding joy and about holding on to it in a world that is less than joyful at the moment. And Amelia Baylor, who is another comedian who I absolutely adore and who has such positive energy, and her show was very upbeat and positive and fun-filled. And also just having the both of our shows were very joyful, but also about the difficulties or, you know, the challenges, you know, whether that's mental health challenges or whether that's aging or whatever it is that you might, you know, come across. How do you still be joyful when there's so much going on? And we I just decided that I would really love to carry on this joy journey. And I asked Amelia if she would join me on the journey of joy. And she said yes, which is really nice. And so we're doing the Joy Agenda. We're about to go into the studio and record episode 10, I think, 10 and 11 this week. And yeah, so it's been a real journey because I had done some podcasting before, so I did know how difficult it was to like edit your own podcast and how time consuming that is. And time is the one thing that I do not have a lot of. I'm very, I'm idea rich and time poor. And so I've made the jump of going, okay, I can't do everything myself, which is a thing that I think I find difficult. And so we're using a proper podcasting studio at Monkey Barrel Comedy Club. We have an editor, Chris Thorburn, who does all the difficult bits. And I know from editing the Mother Half Lives, I mean, that took me, sometimes it would take me 6-7 hours to edit a 45-minute podcast. And I just don't have that time. And so it's really nice. The thing that's positively come out of it is, yes, it's costing me money to do this, and there may not be any recompense of that. I might never see anything back from doing the podcast in real monetary value. But what's really good about it is that you're putting the money back into your own industry. So Chris Thorburn is a comedian, and he is creating opportunities for other comedians. He runs his own show. He does content for other people. He is somebody that I want to invest in. The Monkey Barrel Comedy Club is a fantastic support to Scottish comedians. They offer incredibly good rates for tour shows and for fringe shows. And David at the Monkey Barrel is really supportive. And again, if I'm going to give my money to something, I want to give my money to something that is going to put money back into the community that I'm part of. So I am seeing this comedy podcast as being an opportunity to, yes, do something that might make my future in comedy longer and happier and more successful, but equally that if I'm spending money on it, it's going to the right places and the right people.
And I mean, talking to Liam, I think, you know, they've done a couple of live shows. I think they're doing one at the Glasgow Comedy Festival as well. I mean, do you see possibly, or have you got that in mind about doing a date or two at the Fringe?
We'll see. Amelia and I are incredibly chaotic. the chaos that would ensue from a live Joy Agenda, I have no idea if it would how it would go. But no, I would love to do that. I don't think it'll happen this year, just because, you know, we're a very new podcast. We started podding on the 4th of December, and you know, it would be nice to build up a following. If all of a sudden, you know, we had this massive following and there was like a call for, we want a real live Joy Agenda, then yeah, absolutely, I would love to do it. But, you know, like Chris and Liam had been going for a couple of years during the pandemic, and then for a year after the pandemic, before they did a live. So, you know, I'm kind of, this is a 3-year working plan, I think. But we'll see if the Joy Agenda, if there's joysticks out there that want us to do a live pod, then let's do it.
Cool. And Kathleen, I know you were saying earlier, you were kind of saying something like that may be interesting, but yes, there's only so many hours in the day. And
yeah, I think I would love to. But yeah, it's things you were talking about earlier. If I'm putting something out there for an audience, I want it to be good. You know, I want it to be something that I feel really inspired by and excited about. And that I can put time and effort into. And see, to be honest, at the minute. There are only 24 hours in the day. I don't get enough sleep as it is. I would love to do it in future, but yeah, I think it's a future project for me rather than something I'm going to try and squeeze in.
One of the other things, talking about, you know, kind of the supportive nature in Scottish comedy scene, is that you run the Humour Mill in Glasgow. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that and kind of how that came about.
Yeah, for sure. So it was just kind of from when I started to get a bit more paid work and realised how often I felt, oh, no one told me about this bit. And then if you ask for help, people were more than willing to do it. And I was so grateful to the people who I had reached out to who had taken the time and, you know, the energy to be very like patient and supportive about it. It just made it feel so much like easier. I think it's very easy to feel sometimes like if something is difficult or something is difficult to find out, it can feel like you're not supposed to be in that space if you're not sure how you even go about progressing. And I also think, it, like Jay said, it can be like a very lonely industry. You spend a lot of time on your own. I spend a lot of time on trains, on my own out of drive, so... You know, there's just a lot of sitting by yourself and trying to figure out what you're doing. So I started the Humour Mill because my day job, a lot of it is workshops and training, things like that, facilitating workshops, organising, like networking events. And I just thought I would love to have this, but for comedy, I would love to have a place that, where I can go to. And it's a like supportive, welcoming environment to just like bounce ideas around, say this out loud before someone else hears it. Have people, if I have like a daft question that I'm worried to say out loud, have someone that I can go to and they won't make me feel daft for asking it. So it's been really, really great. It's been really exciting, the number of people who I was worried about. I should maybe explain a little bit more what it is. So monthly, to the best of our ability, we have an open writing group. And that is just we book a space in a cafe or a pub every month. People can come along, they can bring whatever they're working on, if that's sketches, if that's stand-up, if that's like a song they're working on, if they're a drag act, whatever, they can kind of pitch in and say, oh, I didn't quite get that bit, or that was really funny, you should bring that back at the end, these sorts of things. That's completely free. And then we also have ticketed sessions where I'll book someone who's maybe more experienced in a certain area. So our first one we had was Stuart McPherson and Stephen Buchanan, and they gave us a little workshop on writing sketches for TV and radio, which is something they do a lot with Noising Up and things they've done in the past with Scott Squad. So that was really good, and we just kind of did that on rotation. And I was worried about, you know, being able to find, you know, people for those workshops, people who'd be willing to do it for, you know, a price that would still make the tickets accessibly priced, that sort of thing. The number of people who have said, hey, by the way, I don't know if you know, but I have experience in this, or I would be happy to do this, has just been really, really great. And we have a nice little community. Yeah, it's been really nice. It's been a steep learning curve for me as well. And there's so much more I want to do with it. So hopefully that's 2024 will also be, you know, a good time to develop that into something a bit bigger and more secure.
Thanks so much to both of you for your time. I'll put links to everything in the show notes. But if you want to give me a quick recap of things you're involved with at the moment.
I have a preview of my solo show coming to the Glasgow International Comedy Festival. It's called Cryptid. It is about when you were young and you had a vision of yourself as an adult, the way that you were going to be, and realizing that you've, you know, had your younger self be proud of you? Probably not, because they had such grand ideas for you. So yeah, it's all about discovering whether or not the version of yourself you think you are exists. It's kind of camp, silly, like horror stuff. I think it'll be very silly and fun. I'm very excited to do it. So that's Cryptid at the Glasgow International Comedy Festival on the 24th of March at the Cools. And we also have a live show with the Humour Mill. So that will be stand-up improv sketch in a big kind of glorious cake. That will be at the Cools on Wednesday the 20th of March.
So Bahuki is out on tour from the end of February. I'm very excited about that. I have two live recordings, one in Edinburgh at the Monkey Bar Comedy on the 3rd of March, one in Glasgow on the 29th of March of Bahuki, which will form the basis of my live special. And yeah, the Joy Agenda, which comes out every Monday with myself and Amelia Baylor, talking to guests about all things joyful and upbeat and happy and everything, I think. And I've got Bonafide, which is on every month at the Glasgow and Edinburgh Stand Comedy Clubs, which is a night that is all about getting professional comedians to write to the theme. And it's a lot of fun. It's been going for 7 years and it's like one of my babies. So, yeah.
Thanks for listening. There's more details in the show notes about where you can see Jay and Kathleen's shows and where you can find them online. If you enjoyed this, check out some of our previous episodes where we speak to people about making creativity pay.